8. On the brightly lit stage, colorful shapes danced and gestured. The costumed figures sang lustily, bustily. Scenery glimmered with a high sparkle, a small square of brilliance cut in the far end of the hall. The third act was coming to an end. All the characters were on stage. With infinite precision, they gave forth their melodic lines. In the pit, the orchestra, classical and exact, labored furiously. Dominating the opera loomed the aged, wallowing figure of Gaetano Tabelli, long past his prime but still a splendid singer and actor. Purple-faced, near-sighted, the fabulous Tabelli waddled about the stage, an expression of dumbfounded bewilderment on his huge, wrinkled features, struggling grotesquely to find his way through the maze of shadows that made up the world of Beaumarchais. Peering through his eyeglass, Tabelli grossly scrutinized his fellows, bellowing all the while in his vast, familiar, booming bass baritone. A greater Don Bartolo there never was, and never would be. This performance, this zenith of consummate operatic staging, dramatic force, and perfected vocal artistry, had been frozen for all time. Tabelli was dead now 10 years. The bright figures on the stage were scrupulous robot imitations. But even so, the performance was wholly convincing. Relaxed and comfortable in his deep chair, Cusick watched with passive appreciation. He enjoyed Le Nozze di Figaro. He had seen Tabelli many times, he had never become tired of the great performer's finest role, and he enjoyed the gay costumes, the uninterrupted flow of lyrical melody, the pink-cheeked chorus singing pleasant interludes for all they were worth. The music and phantasmagoria of colors had gradually put him in a soporific state. Dreaming, half asleep, he leaned back in his seat and happily absorbed it all. But something was wrong. Awakened, he pulled himself upright. Beside him, Nina sat slumped in rapt satisfaction. Her mood was unbroken. Before he realized what he was doing, he had slid to his feet. Blinking, Nina broke out of her trance. "What?" she whispered, astonished. He made a silencing motion and pushed his way down the row to the aisle. A moment later, he was plodding stonily past rows of attentive faces to the carpeted steps in the rear and the packed standing room. There he paused to take one final look at the stage. The feeling remained, even at this distance. He stepped past the calcified ushers and reached the lobby. There, in the now empty carpeted vault that still smelled of cigar smoke and women's perfume, he halted and lit a fresh cigarette. He was the only person in the whole deserted lobby. Behind him, through the half-open doors, rang the sounds and voices and the sweet fluttering whir of a Viennese symphony orchestra. Vaguely irritated, he prowled around. His restlessness remained, and it hadn't been helped by the quick glare of disapproval that had hardened on Nina's face. He had seen it before. He knew what it meant. Explanations were going to be needed. He winced at the thought. How could he explain? Beyond the lobby of the opera house stretched the night street, sunk in desolate stillness. On the far side were deserted office buildings, black and empty, locked up for the weekend. The entrance of one glowed, a nightlight flickered dully. In the concrete well lay heaps of rubbish blown there by the night wind. Posters, scraps of paper, urban trash of various kinds. Even from where he stood, insulated by thick plate glass doors, by the descending flight of concrete steps, by the wide sidewalk and street itself, Cusick could make out the letters on a crumpled poster. Patria Rallya of the M. Jones Will Public Invi. Torn across the middle, the poster lay sightlessly sprawled. But for every one that had been ripped down by the police, 1,000 still plastered walls, doorways, hung in restaurants, store windows, bars, lavatories, gas stations, schools, offices, private houses, the Pied Piper and his flock, the reek of burning gasoline. When the final thunderous roar of applause burst out, Cusick tensed himself. Already a few eager people scurried from the open doorways. Ushers appeared and rapidly fixed the doors aside. Now the first phalanx of the throng burst forth. Laughing and conversing, pulling their wraps around them, the well-dressed citizens of the main floor poured into the lobby like a jar of expensive costume jewelry abruptly overturned. Down the wide stairs, less elaborately dressed patrons descended. In a moment, Cusick was surrounded by a solid pack of talking, murmuring, noisily gesturing people. Presently, Nina fought her way over to him. "Hello," he said uncomfortably. "What happened?" Nina inquired, half anxiously, half in exasperation. "Did you have some sort of fit?" "Sorry." It was a difficult thing to explain to her. "That last act scenery reminded me of something dismal like that, people creeping around in the darkness." Lightly, Nina said, "Reminded you of business? Police prisons, maybe?" Her voice was tense, sharpened with momentary accusation. "Guilty conscience?" He felt his face flushing. "No, that isn't it." Apparently he answered too loudly. Some of the nearby people glanced curiously around. Cusick snapped his jaws angrily together and shoved his hands deep in his pockets. "Let's talk about it some other time." "All right," Nina said brightly, smiling her familiar flash of white teeth. "No scenes, not tonight." Agilely, she spun on her heel, taking in the sight of the surrounding clusters of people. The tight line of her forehead showed she was still upset. He had no doubts about that. But the clash was going to be postponed. "I'm sorry," Cusick repeated awkwardly. "It's this damn stuff going on. The dark stage reminded me of it. I always forget that whole scene is set at night." "Don't worry about it," Nina answered insistently, wanting to drop the subject. Her sharp nails dug quickly into his arm. "What time is it? Is it midnight?" He examined his wristwatch. "Somewhat after." Frowning, Nina peered urgently toward the sidewalk outside. Taxis were sliding into the loading zone, picking up passengers and starting immediately off.
"Do you think we missed him? He'd wait, wouldn't he? I thought I saw him a second ago as I was coming out."
"Isn't he meeting us at the apartment?" Somehow he couldn't imagine Kaminsky at a Mozart opera. The round-faced, worried man with his thick mustache was from a different century entirely.
"No, dear," Nina said patiently. "He's meeting us here, remember? You were thinking about something else, as usual. We are supposed to wait for him. He doesn't know where we live."
The crowd was beginning to flow from the lobby outside onto the street. Gusts of frigid night air billowed in, coats were put on, furs slipped in place. The intimated odor of perfume and cigar smoke very soon dwindled as the remote, hostile vacuum of the outside world made its way in.
"Our little cosmos is breaking up," Cusick observed morbidly. "The real world is on its way."
"What's that?"
Nina asked vacantly, still critically studying the women around them.
"Look what that girl is wearing, over there, the one in blue."
While Cusick was going through the motions of looking, a familiar figure came threading its way toward them.
"Hi," Kaminsky said as he reached them. "Sorry I'm late, I forgot all about it."
The sight of Max Kaminsky was a shock. He hadn't seen his one-time political instructor in months. Kaminsky was haggard and hunched over. His eyes were bloodshot, underscored with puffy black circles. His fingers trembled as he reached out to shake hands. Under one arm, he clutched a bulky brown-wrapped package. Nodding slightly to Nina, aware of her for the first time, he murmured,
"Evening, Nina. Good to see you again."
You weren't at the opera,
Nina observed, with a distasteful glance at the man's rumpled business suit and the messy package.
No, I missed it.
Kaminsky's hand was wet and clammy. He drew it back and stood clumsily, focusing with an effort.
I can't sit through long things. Well, are we ready to go?
Certainly,
Nina said in an icy voice. Her dismay was fast turning to outright aversion. Kaminsky had evidently been working through a 15-hour double shift. Fatigue and nervous exhaustion were written in every pore of his stooped body.
What's that you have? She asked, indicating the package.
I'll show you later,
Kaminsky assured her noncommittally, tightening his grip.
Let's go then,
Nina said briskly, taking her husband's arm.
Where to?
This girl, Kaminsky muttered, shambling along after them. We have to pick her up. You don't know her. I forgot to tell you about her. Very nice kid. It'll make us an even foursquare.
He tried to laugh, but what came out sounded more like a death rattle.
Don't ask me to introduce her. I don't know her last name. I sort of picked her up in one of the outer offices.
Presently, Nina said,
I'd like to go to the apartment first. I want to see how Jackie is.
Jackie?
Puzzled, Kaminsky hurried down the concrete steps behind them.
Who's that?
Our son,
Nina said distantly.
Oh, that's right, Kaminsky admitted. You have a child. I've never seen him.
His voice trailed off.
With all this work, I don't know if I'm coming or going.
Right now you're going,
Nina said, standing on the curb, her body straight and disapproving, arms folded, waiting rigidly for a taxi.
Are you sure you feel up to this? It looks as if you've already had your share of celebrating.
Cusick said sharply, Cut it. The taxi came and Nina slipped gingerly inside. The two men followed and the taxi shot off into the sky. Below them, the lights of Detroit sparkled and winked, evenly spaced stars in a man-made firmament. Fresh night air swirled into the cabin of the taxi, a harsh but reviving wind that helped clear Cusick's head. Presently, Kaminsky seemed to recover a trifle.
Your husband and I haven't been doing so well lately, he told Nina, a belated apology. You've probably noticed.
Nina nodded.
We're falling apart. The strain.
He grimaced.
It isn't easy to watch everything you stand for falling apart piece by piece, one brick after another.
The graph's still going up? Cusick asked.
Straight up, every region, every stratum. Is getting through to everybody. A cross-section. How the hell can we isolate a thing like that? There's gasoline frying on every street corner in the world.
Nina said thoughtfully,
Does that surprise you?
It's illegal,
Kaminsky retorted with childish venom.
They have no right to kill those things.
The woman's thin, penciled eyebrows went up.
Do you really care about those lumps?
No, Kaminsky admitted. Of course not. I wish they'd all sizzle into the sun, and neither does he. Nobody cares about the drifters one way or another.
How strange,
Nina said in a carefully modulated voice.
Millions of people are resentful, willing to break the law to show their resentment, and you say nobody cares.
Nobody that counts,
Kaminsky said, losing all sense of what he was saying.
Just the dupes care, the idiots. Jones knows and we know. The drifters are a means, not an end. They're a rallying point, a pretext. We're playing a game, a big elaborate game.
Wearily, he muttered,
God hate it.
Then,
Nina said practically,
stop playing it.
Kaminsky brooded. Yeah, maybe you're right. Sometimes I think that. Times when I'm working away, buried in graphs and reports. It's an idea.
Let them burn the drifters, Cusick said. And then what? Is that the end of it?
No.
Kaminsky nodded reluctantly.
Of course not. Then the real business begins, because the drifters aren't here. Only a few of them are in our system. They come from somewhere. They have a point of origin.
Beyond the Dead Eight, Nina said enigmatically. Aroused from his lethargy, Kaminsky pulled himself around to peer at the woman. Shrewd, wrinkled face, dark with suspicion, he was still studying her when the taxi began to lower. Nina opened her purse and found a $50 bill.
Here we are, she said shortly. You can come inside if you want, or you can wait here. It'll only take a second.
I'll come inside, Kaminsky said, visibly not wanting to be left alone. I'd like to see your child. I've never seen him.
As he fumbled for the door, he muttered uncertainly,
Have I?
No, Cossack answered, deeply struck by his aging instructor's deterioration. Carefully he reached past Kaminsky and opened the taxi door. Come on inside and get warm. The living room of the apartment lit up in anticipation as Nina pushed open the front door. From the bedroom came a bubbling, aggravated wail. Jackie was awake and cross. Is he all right? Cusick asked anxiously. Isn't that thing working?
He's probably hungry,
Nina answered, taking off her coat and tossing it over a chair.
I'll go heat up his bottle.
Skirt swirling around her ankles, she disappeared down the hall into the kitchen. Sit down, Cusick said. Kaminsky seated himself gratefully. He laid his package down beside him on the couch.
Nice little place you have here. Clean, fresh, everything new.
We redecorated it when we moved in.
Kaminsky looked around uneasily.
Is there anything, I can do to help?
Help? Cusick laughed. No, unless you're an expert in baby feeding.
I'm not.
Unhappily, Kaminsky picked at the sleeve of his coat.
Never had anything to do with that.
He glanced around at the living room, a wan hunger rising to his face.
You know I sure as hell envy you.
This? The living room was well furnished and tidy, a small, rigorously maintained apartment, showing a woman's taste in furnishings and decoration.
I suppose so, Cusick admitted.
Nina keeps it nice, but it's only four rooms, he added dryly, as Nina occasionally reminds me. Fretfully, Kaminsky said,
Your wife feels a lot of hostility toward me. I'm sorry, it bothers me.
Why does she feel that way?
Police. She resents the service.
Kaminsky nodded.
I thought that was it. It's not popular now. And it's getting less popular. As Jones goes up, we go down.
She never did like it,
Cusick said, his voice soft. He could hear the distant sounds of Nina stirring around in the kitchen, warming the baby's formula, her heels clicking as she hurried into the bedroom, faint murmurs as she talked to the baby.
She came from an information agency. Relativism never sank very deeply into the communication media. They're still tied up with the old slogans of goodness, truth, and beauty. The police aren't beautiful, certainly. And she wonders if they're good.
Sardonically, he went on.
After all, to admit the necessity of the secret police would be to admit the existence of fanatical absolutist cults. But she's heard about Jones. Sometimes I think women are totally passive receptors, like pieces of litmus paper.
Some women, Kaminsky shook his head. Not all.
What the public thinks of Jones, she thinks. I can tell what they believe by talking to her. She seems to get it intuitively by some sort of psychic osmosis.
Presently, he added, one day she stole some little glasses from a store. I couldn't figure it out at the time. Later, I understood it. But it took two more times to make it clear.
Oh, Kaminsky said. Yes, of course. You're a cop. She resents you, so she breaks the law. She asserts herself against cops.
He glanced up.
Does she understand it?
Not exactly. She knows she feels moral indignation at me. I like to think it's nothing but outworn slogan idealism, but maybe it's more. Nina's ambitious. She came from a good family. Socially, she'd like to be sitting up in the boxes, not down on the main floor. Being married to a cop has never been socially useful. There's a stigma. She can't get over that.
Kaminsky said thoughtfully,
you say that. But I know you're completely in love with her.
Well, I hope I can keep her.
Would you leave security to keep her, if it was a choice?
I can't say.
I hope I never have to make the choice.
Probably it depends on where this Jones thing goes, and nobody can see that, except Jones.
Nina appeared in the doorway.
He's fine now. We can go.
Rising to his feet, Cusick asked,
you feel like going out?
I certainly do, Nina said emphatically. I'm not going to sit around here, I can tell you that much.
As the woman collected her things, Kaminsky asked hesitantly,
Nina, could I see Jack before we leave?
Nina smiled, her face softened.
Sure, Max, come on in the bedroom.
She put down her things.
Only don't make too much noise.
Kaminsky gathered up his package, and the two men obediently followed her. The bedroom was dark and warm. In his bassinet, the baby lay soundly sleeping, one hand raised to his mouth, knees drawn up. Kaminsky stood for a time, hands on the railing of the bassinet. The only sound was the baby's muted rasp and the continual click of the robot watcher.
He wasn't really hungry, Nina said. It had fed him.
She indicated the watcher.
He just missed me.
Kaminsky started to reach down toward the baby, then changed his mind.
He's healthy looking, he said awkwardly. Looks a lot like you, Doug. He has your forehead, but he's got Nina's hair.
Yes, Cusick agreed.
He's going to have nice hair. What color eyes?
Blue, like Nina. The perfect human being, my powerful intellect and her beauty.
He put his arm around his wife and held her tight. Chewing his lip, Kaminsky said half aloud,
I wonder what the world's going to be like when he grows up. I wonder if he'll be running through ruins with a gun and an armband, chanting a slogan.
Abruptly, Nina turned and left the bedroom. When they followed, they found her standing at the living room door, her coat on, purse under her arm, pulling on her gloves with rapid, jerky motions.
Ready?
She demanded in a clipped voice. With her sharp toe, she kicked open the hall door.
Then let's go. We'll pick up this girl of Max's and get underway.